Welcome back to the Lumieres podcast with me, Jody White. This podcast is a slowly weaving thread bringing together people with a gift, a story, or a mission to share at the intersection where creative expression, holistic health, and grounded spirituality meet. My guest today is musician Owen Shears, also known as Kenevan. I first met Owen back in 2011 down in Devon, where we were both on the same intake of The Journey, the flagship course run by Mac McCartney and his team at Embercombe. Since that time, Owen's moved back to his native Wales, and in 2019 he put out his first album, a musical project with a difference. Dilyn Afon, or Following a River, is the result of 3 years of research and work collecting, arranging and recording folk songs from Ceredigion. This is a project which aims to put West Wales and its fragile traditions firmly back on the musical map. It's an evocative, timeless work, and I highly encourage everyone to seek it out and give it a listen. And if you like it, support the artist directly by buying it on Bandcamp or wherever else you buy your music. So the word Kenevan itself is swaddled in layers of meaning. It's a Welsh noun with no direct equivalent in English. Its origins lie in a farming term used to describe the habitual tracks and trails worn by animals in hillsides. The word has since morphed and deepened to conjure a very personal sense of place, belonging, and familiarity. This conversation with Owen was recorded late last year in a small roundhouse on the side of a very windy hill near Mahuncleth in West Wales. The local wild horses were very intrigued by what we were doing and even tried to break in at one point, as you will hear. So we spoke about Owen's journey to making the record, Dilyn Afon, what it means to be a cultural conservationist, and how urgent it is that we don't stand by while our heritage slips slowly into extinction. But before we dive in, a quick plug for my upcoming book reading events in Prestine at the Assembly Rooms on April 9th, and in Hay on Wye on the Saturday, April 22nd, that's at North Books. If you want to come to those, you can find tickets and more information at midborderarts.com. and northbooks.co.uk. If you don't know about my first book, Chimera, Living Through Leukemia, a memoir, then you can check it out online at bookshop.org, Amazon, or Goodreads, or just go to my website at jodywhite.co.uk/chimera, C-H-I-M-E-R-A, and you can find out all about this wonderful piece of work. If you would like to support this podcast and help it continue, you can pledge a couple of pounds a month via the link over at patreon.com/Jody White. Now, with no further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Owen Shears. So, okay, a good place to start. I think the first time we met
was on The Journey, wasn't it?
It was on The Journey at Embercombe.
Yeah, wow.
So I think that was like, I mean, that was November 2011. Yeah. So we are 11 years almost to the day-ish.
Wow.
From that experience, which was pretty wild for me. I don't know what it was like for you. Yeah. My memory of you initially, or my first impression of you, was very, very dry humour and quite serious.
That sounds about right for me at age 26 or 27.
How old are you? 26?
I was 26, I think. Or I can't remember. 27, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That was a pivotal experience, I think, and especially that group. Like, there was something about that group particularly that I remember, like, Mac and the people that were there at the time afterwards telling me, like, yeah, that group was wild, a lot different to a lot some of the other groups. Just, yeah,
I remember hearing that as well. Mm. I think they said something like, it's not normally like that.
Yeah. Yeah,
I guess maybe it was the effect of when you have a critical mass of people really going for it and kind of egging each other on, and people getting inspired by other people's courage or vulnerability, and then it kind of spirals.
Yeah, definitely.
That's what it felt like to me anyway.
Definitely, yeah. No, it was special, really special memories. And for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about a place called Embercombe, which is near Exeter. in Devon, and it's been going for a long time, and they run it's this kind of crossover between sort of Western psychology and sort of animistic, like older shamanic-y kind of approaches, like ceremony, ritual, and, you know, but very much kind of more grounded in the isles of this land. Mm. Yeah, if you're interested, check them out. I think it's embercombe.org is their website.
Mm.
That's 11 years ago. Wow. So what drew you there at the time? Like, because it's the journey course, it's their flagship kind of course, is very much advertised as something for people who are a bit of a crossroads in life.
Mm. That would definitely describe me at that point in my life, certainly. What drew me there? Well, I ended up actually living there for a year and a half.
That's right. So were you volunteering there afterwards?
I ended up doing the apprenticeship program.
Oh, that's it, yeah.
Yeah. But what preceded that was, I guess, leaving uni, and I did a degree in music, which was great. I had a great time. And then I ended up doing a lot of... I ended up not playing music for a while. I was doing tech work and ended up doing quite high-end tech work. I was working for Peter Gabriel at Real World Studios.
When you say tech work, do you mean like engineering side of things?
Yeah, sounds engineering. Yeah. And, touring.
I didn't know you were at Real World Studios.
Yeah, so I worked there for a bit, like a year, and it was quite intense. I was doing like 15, 16-hour days sometimes.
Was that when Chad was still there?
I think it was just after. Okay. I mean, they have had a very high turnover of engineers over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
It's it was quite intense work, and it was very stimulating, but also very demanding. And I wasn't playing music, and I was just facilitating other people's music, which, you know, you learn a lot. But ultimately, I think I was getting to that point where I was starting to ask myself, like, well, what about my own creativity and my own vision? So, I'd already been to Embercombe, I think in 2009, for a friend's weekend, like with my then girlfriend, whose mum I think had taken a school group there, and she was raving about it. I really had a great time and felt very inspired by the place. And I'd always said to myself, I'd like to go back for longer. And so I remember I was working on, I think it was Peter Gabriel's live album, New Blood, DVD. And we finished that, and we took his kayak down the river from the studio just to have like some time off. And I remember thinking, this is the most fun I've had in I don't know how long. And at that point I thought, well, actually, so I've got to change something if this is more fun than what I'm spending my day to day doing. So I had a bit of time off, and I applied to go and volunteer at Embercombe for 2 weeks, and ended up at Embercombe on some time off. And it happened to be the same period when they were receiving applications for the apprenticeship program, which at that point was a year long immersive course, living on site, receiving mentorship and training, and also working as well. And there were four positions, and nobody'd applied for the site apprentice job.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, I guess I was having conversations along the lines of, oh, this is, you know, I'm not sure about what I'm doing in my life, blah blah blah. Anyway, somebody, I can't remember who, said, why didn't you go for the site apprentice position? And I went, no, it was like, no, don't be silly. Anyway, the next day I'm in the garden, and Mac sort of strides towards me through the herbs or whatever, bare chested. It was a boiling hot day, I remember this. He was pretty much almost bare chested with his shirt like undone, and just made me this offer. You know, I really think it seems like you're at that place, you know, have you considered doing the apprenticeship? And I couldn't really say no.
He's not a guy that you easily say no to.
No, especially when it's put so eloquently and so persuasively.
Yeah.
So I considered it a lot more seriously, and I think they had the interviews like a few days later. And I remember just sitting on top of the mound.
Yeah.
And I remember actually, I think I phoned my folks and I just said, look, I need to make a change. And they were like, yeah, we'll go for it. But it was definitely...
Were you still working at the studio at that point?
I was, yeah. 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 It was definitely, it made no sense at all from a career progression point of view. You know, there are thousands of people who would probably want that job in that studio.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big turnover of graduates from tech courses who would kill for that job.
Yeah.
But it was a gut decision. And I think I remember saying, after they offered it to me, I remember saying to Mac, like, this makes no sense to me. I think this will make sense in 10 years' time. I think I was right. But it was an interesting gut decision to make at that point. You know,
Was, how did they react when you told them at the studio? What did you say, oh, I'm leaving to go and do this thing?
Well, I wasn't on a long-term contract. I was part-time in some ways, and they can always find other people. It's not like short on people. They were like, sad to see you go, but that's fine. So I ended up at Embercombe, and it was just a complete change in my life. I don't think at the time I really realized how much it would change who I am and the direction my life was headed in. But I'm very glad I made that decision. Probably the biggest decision I've ever made in my life, I would say.
Yeah.
To date. So, that's a long answer to your question.
No, that's great. That's really interesting. What did they have you doing on this? Because I knew a few people that were volunteering at the time who also were on the journey. I think that was part of the apprenticeship, was it? Or there was something had to do it?
So,
the vibe that I got from people that had been volunteering there for a while was that it was hard work. Wasn't just like a kind of hippy dippy hanging around singing in the flowers kind of thing. It was like up early on it, working hard. Everybody's got their stuff that they need to do, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, to say a little bit more about the vision for Embercombe, I think one of Mac's original descriptions for the vision he had was a garden that grows people. So it's often been called a leadership center.
Yeah.
And so the purpose of it really is to ask very challenging questions of you. You know, more challenging questions than your education or our culture might ask of us. Certainly that was my experience. And so that was, I would say, the guiding light behind the apprenticeship program. But there was a very day-to-day practical element to it. It was a bit of a shock using my body suddenly after, you know, a while of sitting in studios. It'd be very physical labor at times. But I quite enjoyed that as well. And being very involved in the day to day running, both on a practical sense, but also doing facilitation. And we got bushcraft training, and we're very involved in the whole thing, basically. And alongside that, we had mentoring. So we had monthly learning sets with Mac, where he'd cook for us and we'd sit and we'd do sort of tasks, or he'd lead us through an exercise or something. We also had individual coaches. So I worked with a really wonderful woman called Juliet Bakler, who was really fantastic. And we also had access to Jonathan, who was the on-site therapist who stopped everyone going mad. I think in any community situation, you normally have a percentage of people who are on the verge of having a breakdown or losing the plot. Or I think he did a lot of invisible work, which maybe wasn't always sort of visible on the kind of surface, but he definitely kind of helped people through a lot of transition. So it was a really comprehensive year of intense personal development work and learning about myself and really who I was, I think, for the first time. And I got quite ill during that period. I was really run down. And I overworked myself.
Right.
It was a 9-to-5, which I'd never done before in such a physical sense.
It
was very demanding. And one of the biggest lessons was around my health and going through that. So, challenged on many, many fronts, you know, completely out of my comfort zone.
Yeah. It's amazing that you had the courage to say yes to that when it was offered. Because I don't know if everyone would, given such a big, in the position that you're in quite like a cozy position, seemingly going to follow that studio thing. I mean, lots of people would have gone, that sounds a bit nuts.
I mean, from one perspective, it was. I mean, It's only now that I can look back and say and have gratitude for it. There was a period afterwards where I was like, what did I just do?
How did you feel when you kind of finished the year and then you're like, well, right, did you have like, did it give you clarity? Did it help you get a sense of the next steps? Or were you still just kind of like, that was important, I don't know why, but here I am sort of thing? Like,
there was a period after I left where I was quite lost, I think, because it was like you take the lid off the Pandora's box and everything comes out and you're sat there trying to make sense of the pieces. And that takes time, I think. And I think when you finding those, the answers to those big questions around like, what am I really here for? Like what's the purpose of my life? Like that does take time.
Oh yeah.
And I think it was probably I spent a lot of time figuring it that out. And it was, yeah, that year, I think, even though it felt like the longest year of my life, it was the beginning of that process, or at least, you know, a good kickstart of that process. So yeah, when I left, I think I was, in some ways, that was even more challenging.
Right.
And also I'd lived in community for a year. I'd gotten used to communal meals. I'd gotten used to just having a very integrated way of living and been very close intimacy with a lot of people, and suddenly like that was just gone. So that was a bit of a kind of hard reality kind of.
So what did you do when that ended then, after that, in that period?
Oh blimey, I did a bit of traveling. I remember I went to West Africa for a bit, went back to my folks for a bit. Yeah, it was, I would say, definitely a bit of a wandering period. I bought Gypsy caravan. I lived at a place called Land Matters for a bit, south of Totnes, which was another interesting immersion in communal living, very different to Embercombe. But I learned a lot of quite hard lessons around who I wasn't in that period. I think I'd taken on this idea that I had to be living off grid and I had to be not consuming any fossil fuels and I had to be living as close to the earth as possible and eating worms or whatever, you know.
Yeah, extreme.
I'd gone to a bit of an extreme, I think. Yeah. And that period, I think, for me was around learning that actually you can't do everything. And if you want to be creative as well, you have to make sacrifices in that sense. And so, you know, my living situation now is a lot more domestic than it was then.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, I think that period was maybe marked by going to those kind of extremes and doing quite extreme things and experimenting. And
but yeah, it gave you a solid grounding in this way of living and way of being.
Yes,
outside of the normal to a degree. It seems like you have carried that on through the rest of your years following.
Yeah, I feel very grateful that I was taught some really useful transferable skills during that period, especially the bushcraft side of things. It gave me a whole new appreciation.
Was that with Mark?
Mark Lane.
Shout out, Mark.
Hey, great teacher.
Yeah, lovely man. I shared the yurt with him on my journey.
Oh, there we go, yeah.
Yeah, hilarious. What hilarious. things I can't repeat, actually.
Right. I'm sure he'll repeat them himself. But also just on a practical sense, you know, I was doing a lot of building work and driving the tractor and, you know, I feel a lot more comfortable in nature now than I did before, and sleeping out a lot and just going off.
That was one of the big things that a lot of people said about the journey, was like it was the first time or one of the early times that they were encouraged to go and sleep out in the woods at night. Yeah. And that can be a really big thing for a lot of people.
I would say one of the, that's made me think actually of one experience we had where we were given a task by Mac. We came up with it. He asked us to come up with a task ourselves. It was called the mission. And he told us this. He was always encouraging us to think outside our own box and put ourselves out of our comfort zones. And I think he called it like a James Bond mission or something like that, along those lines. And he told us this story about the 1987 hurricane when all the power went off and he had to make a phone call, and he I think he like broke into Barclays headquarters. So he knew they'd have a working phone, and he managed to get into the CEO's office and make a phone call or something. But he was using this as an example.
Amazing.
Of like, I want you to think of your own mission.
So okay.
The four of us decided to try and live for a week without.
Oh, so it was,
food
it was a communal mission.
Well, there were four apprentices. So the
but
apprentices,
the mission was for you all to do this together rather than off on
sorry,
your
yeah.
own.
No, yeah. there was individual ones as well.
Yeah,
but we decided to try and live for a week without food or money. And we wanted to get to Lindisfarne, the island. So we didn't make it, but we tried to hitch up to Lindisfarne.
Yeah, it's quite away from Exeter.
Yeah, we got as far as the Peak District, basically. But then we ran out of time. But we had an amazing time. It was, again, another, probably one of the most transformational weeks of my life. Mm. We were sleeping out and we were using all these skills that we'd kind of picked up. And that experience removed a huge fear barrier for me, not only in terms of having my immediate like physical needs met around food, sleep, money, shelter, just suddenly finding that stuff manifested when you're in a zone of openness and a place of kind of receptivity. But also, opened my eyes to what can happen when you're, it's like in Harry Potter, you know, when he takes the lucky potion. Do you know that one?
Do you know what?
Just happens to him.
I'm going to make a confession that
You've
I haven't read or okay. seen. I actually haven't read or seen a Harry Potter.
Okay. There's a potion he takes called, is it Felix Felice or something like that? It's like a lucky potion. It was like we'd all taken that for a week and just mad stuff kept happening to us.
Wow.
And it sounds like such a cliche, but it helped me trust life a lot more doing that kind of thing. And that obviously had to have the practical skills to enable that, but that was a really transformative experience. And so since then, you know, I'll go off now and I'll go for long walks, like a week long or whatever, and sleep out, and it doesn't really bother me. Whereas I never ever would have done that previously.
Wow.
So
that's amazing. Yeah. And just having that opportunity to meet yourself in that way, such a gift that they encouraged you to go and develop.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it takes practice as well. It doesn't happen.
No. It's challenging.
It's a huge barrier.
Yeah.
But yeah, once you start feeling comfortable out in nature, I think it's a real gift. And we're lucky in this country that we don't have bears or, you know, killer insects or spiders or whatever. You know, it's very safe here, generally
speaking. Wow, man, that's amazing. Are you still in touch with the, I imagine you are still in touch with the other apprentices?
From time to time, yeah. We keep threatening to have a reunion at some
mission.
Point. But we do see each other probably like once a year or something like that. But it was a mad thing that we all shared. And also there were apprentices the year before, 2 years before my year, and also afterwards. And I helped actually train some of the later apprentices in the bushcraft stuff. So I'm in touch with them as well. So there's
cool,
like a whole alumni of people who kind of all had the same experience.
That's nice. That's really nice. I don't know if they're still running that program, but
it's called something.
Things
else.
Have changed quite a lot.
Yeah, it's changed mass. Oh, it's changed enormously. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But this whole way through all this, you had the music. Your music. You're kind of. Have you been playing guitar since you were a kid? Like, how? What's the relation? Mm. Where does the thread with the music and wanting to perform your own music get woven into the? To the story?
That's a really great question. I grew up in a very musical family. My dad makes harps.
And makes harps?
Yeah.
So wow.
I grew up kind of surrounded by harp music and Welsh music as well.
Because the harp is a Welsh...
It's the national instrument. Yeah. So he's, until recently, been Wales's only harp maker. And so I guess I grew up with that kind of cultural inheritance, or just kind of immersed in that, and not, you don't really think about it when you're growing up, but you take it for granted maybe. But that's certainly been a part of my journey.
Were you involved in the kind of in those sort of national musical
the Eisteddfods? Yeah, I mean, most children in Wales will be forced into
that. Is it that you have no choice?
You have no choice, basically. Yeah, so that again, that was another part of my upbringing. But I think by the time I hit teenagerhood, I was in full-blown rebellion. I just got into grunge and just grew my hair and played rock. And
brilliant.
Yeah. Listened to Incubus all day.
Me too.
Yeah, great band.
That's a learning in itself, you know? All that stuff is like just going and getting into things because that's all part of it, right?
Yeah. So I was very isolated. I grew up in a really small village in called Capeldewi in the middle of West Wales, and I wasn't exposed to the kind of culture you would get in a city. So,
sure.
So I was very thirsty for new things and you know, stuff that wasn't the thing I'd grown up with. And I guess I carried that into uni, and I went to college first, actually, because I was going to do computer science because I did maths A level, and then I changed my mind and I went to college and did music A level and a BTEC, and then I went to uni. To do a degree in, it was called commercial music, but it was quite broad.
Commercial music? Yeah. Where was that?
At Bath Spa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Great course. I had a great time. And so by that point, I was very serious about, you know, being a musician. You'd have to be to do a degree in it. But in terms of going back to your question, like, how does this all tie in? I guess I received a very thorough practical professional training doing those courses and doing that degree. You know, which is what you do need that. You know, you need to know how to play, how to perform, how to.
And especially these days when you can, you know, if you've got some of those skills and you know a bit more about the technology side of things, you can just do a lot of it yourself.
There's
levels of degrees of, you know, these things, but in terms of getting something down for yourself and for other people and, it's doable.
Yeah, definitely. I was fortunate to have all that, and you know, an understanding of the music industry and business and all that stuff, which is really important if you're serious about being a musician. But what I didn't get, I would say, from that time was the bigger questions that were then asked of me at Embercombe, which was like, what do you read? The three questions they ask as part of the journey anyway. So what do you love? What do you truly and deeply love? What are your gifts? And what are your responsibilities? And so when I applied that to the things that I really loved, it was very challenging because I'd stopped playing music by the time I arrived there. I'd been doing touring and stuff, and I had I was involved in music, but I'd stopped, and I'd done bits of writing and I'd stopped performing.
You'd stopped writing your own stuff?
It was just, I'd done a few bits and pieces. I'd done some library music after I left uni, but I hadn't performed for ages. And so I was asked these questions, and I think initially I wasn't really honest with myself. I think I'd sort of accepted that that part of my life was over and, you know, I was going to go and save the world. Building compost toilets or something. And then I got ill. And I think that was the thing that forced me to really reassess, like, what are my physical limitations? Like, I have a liver condition. It's not serious, but it means I don't have the normal energetic capacity of most people. And I realized that I wasn't cut out for hard physical labor. Found out the hard way. I remember I went for a bilirubin test at the doctor's, and it was like four times the normal.
Is that Gilbert syndrome?
Yeah, Gilbert syndrome. Yeah. It was four times the normal rate. And the doctor was like, you need to stop. I was going yellow, basically.
Is there a relationship between, obviously there is, but the relationship between the level of your bilirubin and, like, does it have an impact on physical energy?
Oh yeah,
you get a direct kind of
totally. Yeah, I mean, stress is the thing that triggers it because they're huge. There's things like alcohol and fatty food, but stress and lack of sleep are the two things that will knacker you.
Yeah,
if you've got Gilbert's, well, like most people, but it's more pronounced. the symptoms are like nausea, lethargy. Just feeling crap, basically, which is what I was feeling. So that was a good, like, baseball bat around the head from my body, just saying, actually, I know I know you think you're in the right place doing the right thing, but something's not right. And so by that point, I think I went, I went and did a very short tour with a kora player called Tumani Diabati. I did sound. I think that was during that year.
Live sound, that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually had a really good time. It was just a complete change of scene from my normal kind of day to day. But I was working with this guy called John Hollis, who's been another great mentor of mine. And it just threw me back into the music world. And I really fell in love with the kora as an instrument. And it just got me thinking again, like, you can't just forget music. And so I started applying those questions more carefully to music. And so towards the end of my time at Embercombe, I'd kind of stepped back from doing a lot of the manual work. And I remember I put in a request to do something more creative. So I said, I want to stop for like 2 weeks and just concentrate on a creative project. And Jonathan lent me his little shack down by the lake, and I just wrote music for a week.
Oh, brilliant.
Which we used for a film that they were making about Embercombe. And I was like, oh, this is what I need to be doing, really. So it was quite a hard realization to come to. I learned the hard way, but sometimes so that's how you find out.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah.
And so after that, I felt a lot clearer about, okay, I'm not going to do timber framing. I really need to be a musician.
Yeah.
So that didn't come from the journey straight away. Huh. You know? It took a year of banging my head against the wall.
And realizing your physical limitations.
Yeah. And so when I left, that was a whole new challenge, because I think the thing that had changed for me was the type of music I was playing or listening to before I went in was quite different. And so it was more like, how do I make sense of all my experiences here and translate that into music? Like, what am I singing about? Like, what's the narrative? What's the point of it?
Yeah.
Like, so that was the next challenge, I guess.
That's the question that I imagine where the best music comes from, whether it's fully conscious or not. But, you know, there's so much music that clearly doesn't ask deeper questions, and maybe that's fine. But I think when you listen to something that has there's certain qualities of depth and like the way somebody approaches their art, their craft, you know, when they're coming from a place of bringing all these questions with them into the work, I think there's something you can pick up on in that. That would be my sense anyway.
Yeah. Something I think that really helped me on my way with that question was, well, I mentioned the tour with Tumani, but one of the first things I did after I left Embercombe was I engineered an album, Catherine Finch and Sekou Keita's first album. And that was the first Welsh related thing I'd done since school, actually. A Wales related thing.
And she's a harpist, right?
Yeah, so yeah. She's known our family since she was a teenager, but that, you know, I'd been working with Tumani and other artists who were playing their folk music, their indigenous music, and it was so mind-blowing to me. And I'd also been working with Colombian artists and Sekou as well. And suddenly I was seeing music in a completely different context. And I'd also just gone out to West Africa and I'd seen it in its native habitat. And it completely blew my mind. It was like, oh, this music makes sense because it's here. It's from here.
Yeah.
It has a rich tradition. It has a cultural context. So the cogs were whirring after that. And I worked on this album with Katrin and Sekou, and John was doing a bit of research and he asked my advice with a few bits of folk music research and stuff because they were trying to find tunes, and that kind of perked my interest really. And I remember being at WOMEX, which is a big world music expo thing. And it was in Cardiff, and it was like this opening gala, like this is Wales. And that again was another kind of interesting pivotal point. That was on the night of my Saturn's return, actually. I clocked it and I was like, this is interesting. It's like, it was almost like my life being played back to me on stage. Like,
right.
Kind of, all the stuff I grew up with.
Yeah.
That I kind of thought was crap. And then there it was on a stage. And I was just like, oh, this is weird. This is a song I haven't heard since I was 8 years old. I used to sing a folk song or whatever.
Oh, so there was traditional Welsh music there as well?
Yeah, yeah. So because it was okay. hosted by Cardiff, they put on the opening night.
Right.
Just a bit like a musical This Is Your Life kind of
okay.
thing.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And so there were a few things that happened after I left Embercombe which helped me, I guess, piece together or try to help me answer that question of like, what does music that has a deeper sense of meaning or a deeper sense of place sound like, or what is it? So
where did the seed for the album come from? Because you're talking about, I can see that this is like painting a picture here, and we're going into like, I can feel all the bits coming together.
Yeah.
Into how that you're talking about the sense of place in music that's rooted in a cultural context.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in the kind of what's the genesis that then grew into your record.
I think it was a sort of slow evolution, really. The other thing I'd realized coming out of Embercombe was that I needed to play live again. So I actually went to London for a bit, a couple of winters, and I just hit the open mic scene just to cut my teeth a bit with live performing on my own. Because previously I'd just been playing guitar.
Yeah.
How
was that?
It was pretty tough.
Yeah.
You know, you're not making any money. I'd sold my caravan, which is why I was living off. And, you know, I never saw it as a long-term move. It was more kind of sprat to catch a mackerel, as my dad would say. But I also got involved in a few choirs down there, which was good fun. So I had some good musical experiences, some good sort of, you know, musical experiences that were pushing me in terms of live performance.
Mm.
But at the same time, I guess I was still carrying the seed of that question around my own roots and... I started dabbling with like doing versions of the odd Welsh folk song and singing those at open mics, and that they would often get the best response. But people would come up after me and say, like, "Oh, I liked your stuff, but your Welsh song was really lovely," or whatever.
were you primarily like writing and
singing?
I was singing in English.
Yeah, I released an EP. I think it was 2015 in English. But I think more and more at that point, I was turning more back towards my roots and becoming more interested in the things I'd left when I was sort of 18.
Yeah.
And over time I was started doing more stuff in Wales and coming back more often than to the point where it seemed silly to stay in London. So, there was no single incident that suddenly was like an aha moment, but it was more like a natural progression that made sense to me.
Mm.
And the other thing that happened was I ran into a chap called Robin Gray who devised the show 3 Acres and a Cow.
Rings a bell.
It's a show about land rights and history and protest in England that he devised about 10 years ago. And I ran into him at a festival and he just said, "Well, you should do the Welsh version." And I was like, "All right." And I was sort of desperate for anything at that point. I was just sort of like... really needing work and money and something creative to stimulate me.
Uh-huh.
So he really supported me and a friend of mine called Gwilym to devise the Welsh version. And that's still going, that show. Suddenly, I was reading all these Welsh history books and just, I don't know, maybe I'd just matured by that point, but a part of me was a lot more interested in my roots and suddenly seeing all this stuff that I'd been oblivious to growing up or had just taken for granted, and suddenly it started making a lot more sense to me to pursue all this stuff. And I guess I evolved or grew a genuine curiosity and passion and an interest in it. And around that time, I got a scholarship. Oh, that's what happened. There was a program on S4C, which is the Welsh Language Channel, about the Clatwood Valley where I grew up from like early 70s. And it was an author called T. Llew Jones who used to come to our primary school and read to us when I was a kid.
Oh, wow.
And he's walking up the valley and it's this beautiful like art film, really beautifully shot with him walking up the valley, meeting all these characters along the way. And one of them is this balladeer called Daff Jones, who's died now. But there was a song on this program that I'd not heard before and he's singing it. And I was like, "Oh, I wonder if anyone's written that down or where I could get a copy." And turns out nobody had written it down. It was the only place it existed was on that program.
As an oral piece.
Yeah. And an a cappella piece. And I was like, oh, well, I wonder what else is out there. And that was the start of doing all that research.
It was like,
Oh, well, if that's not been written down, then what else is out there? And so that I got a scholarship from the Finzi Trust to research folk singing in Ceredigion. And that was just, another snowballed from there, basically.
That's a great opportunity.
So it gave me a bit of academic legitimacy to be able to go to the library and be like, I've got a scholarship. And just, but it was, people were quite surprised. Or they were like, oh, we've got a horse trying to get in the door here.
Several wild horses trying to break in.
People were quite surprised, I think, or just sort of didn't really know. I'd be like, what? Why would you be interested in those old things? I think this is local people now in Capeldewi. But once I think they understood, they were really helpful. And still now people will send me stuff, So it's great to do a project that's, you can't just find out the answers on Google.
Right.
I think, again, it's like thinking out the box and knocking on doors and interviewing people and following leads and hunches. And sometimes they don't lead anywhere, but... Mm. Yeah,
it involves really human, cool treasure human connection, right?
It involves,
it's about picking, digging, finding these kind of fragments of things and then trying to bring them out again. And that's really valuable. And if people don't do that kind of treasure hunting in a way, that's when things get lost, That's how languages get lost, how stories get lost. That's how so much of culture gets lost. I think it feels like it was that you were really onto something there. I mean,
perhaps it takes somebody who has a more outside perspective to be able to say to someone who has a particular piece of knowledge or wisdom that what they have is valuable. And that's what I've experienced often in talking to older generations, particularly, is they'll say something and they won't realize the value of it. And I think that's a theme all over the world.
Sure.
It's not just unique to Wales, but one of my favorite things is to go and hang out with old people and talk to them about stuff, because they don't, to them it's like irrelevant or out of date, or this horse is really trying to get in the door. To them it might seem like it's not relevant to the modern age, or because that's the narrative they've been told. The skill set they developed growing up is no longer relevant. They can't use computers, they're not on social media,
and
they might know how to shoe a horse or repair a reaper binder machine, or I don't know, so many examples like that.
And I think there's a thing about the value that's placed on things that are not of the current paradigm. So everything's very flashy, using the technology of the moment, on the platforms of the moment. It's all about the value, in some senses, by wider culture, is these sort of easily consumable, takeaway, very sort of fast paced nuggets of art and culture and music and all that stuff. But there's so much that's then like we were just saying, potentially lost or losable or fades away without much fanfare, and that's kind of tragic.
I think it's partly related to the pace of change that we've witnessed over the last 100 years, which has been quicker than our ability to actually understand the impacts of it. And it's only in hindsight that once something's gone, it seems to be the general trend anyway, that once something's gone, we suddenly understand, oh, shit.
I feel like because we've got more of maybe it's amongst certain groups of people, but I feel like because we've got more of an awareness of things disappearing these days, perhaps, through whether it be species extinction or the loss of stories or languages and that kind of stuff, there is just a bit more awareness in general of people realizing that there is a real value in trying to preserve and save and restore. And I feel like this project and this album is all part of that.
Yeah, I guess I was trying to make a point, which was that you don't realize what's under your feet, kind of thing. And there was definitely a personal musical ambition in there as well, to express myself artistically and all that kind of stuff, and hopefully earn a living. That was all part of my kind of aims, but certainly in terms of challenging a narrative, that was definitely part of it. And I think I've come to understand, well, just rewinding a little bit, the village I grew up in, it didn't get electricity till 1965. And so it's not just, there's a whole mindset there, a way of seeing the world, which is a lot less conditioned by modernity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's really precious. And that's not, and so people wouldn't watch TV or listen to the radio. They would write poetry or sing or play dominoes or whatever in the evenings by paraffin light, you know. I mean, I remember a woman who used to use a paraffin light in the early 90s. So it's not just about the songs. It is about a worldview and a way of seeing the world.
Sure.
And a way of being. And it's, I think that's really precious as well. And so, but paradoxically entwined with that is a striving towards modernity. Because they had no running water or electricity, they wanted all the mod cons.
Yeah, we don't want to overly romanticize struggle. Yeah.
It sounds romantic now.
People did struggle, and things are generally easier for people these days. But yeah, it's never black and white.
No, and they were poor. And so who are we to say that you shouldn't have all the mod cons and hot running water and a jacuzzi and that's what people want in West Wales. It sounds mad. And ironically, it's the people who move into West Wales who have a more romanticized view who will do up an old cottage or something like that rather than live in a pebble dash bungalow.
Right.
And like, I'm not judging that. I'm just observing the effect that has culturally, which is, it has a presiding mindset of if it's old, it's useless.
Right. Yeah.
And that's, I guess, what I was trying to challenge. It's branched out from music more recently, mm-hmm. but at that point, that's what I was trying to challenge, was the idea that these things are really important, because they're not just, you know, really interesting pieces of music or art, but they're also reflective of a worldview, which is disappearing very quickly.
Yeah. Am I correct in thinking that the songs that you found and chose for the album were then reworked by you or rearranged to a degree?
There's one song that I rearranged a bit more drastically. The others are, in terms of melodies, they're pretty much verbatim. I might have changed one note in a few, but yeah, apart from Typha Kadidi, which is one I chopped quite a lot out of and jigged around, they're pretty much faithful to the original melodies. But of course, the originals would have been sung a cappella.
A cappella, right.
So that's, you know, but I think that's, I saw that as an invitation to bringing instrumentation and experiment, and people's attention spans have changed in the last 100 years. Like, there's some songs that have 25 verses, which would take half an hour to sing. I mean,
wow.
If I released that album, nobody would listen to it. So there's a payoff somewhere in there. And so I actually chose the songs that I found melodically the most interesting. And there's a side here around Welsh folk music and the Bardic tradition, but Welsh melodies tend to be a bit simpler than like Gaelic, you know.
Okay.
They're less ornamented. Yeah, in terms of the melodies, I was quite faithful to the originals, and I was just sort of more ambitious with the instrumentation and using different tunings on guitar. And
yeah, the instrumentation's lovely, and the whole recording is, the quality of the recording, I think, is really quite stands out for me, like the production side of things. Yeah. I don't know if you had a hand in that as well. I imagine you did.
Well, there's a mad story in here, because I mentioned John Hollis earlier. Yes. So I met John actually when I was living in Bath, and I did some tours for him. He was really the person that introduced me to a lot of sort of...
And he's in the music industry, is he?
Yeah,
John?
So he set up WOMAD with Thomas Brumman.
Okay.
Peter Gabriel back in the 80s, and runs a little label called Astar Artes, who released the album. And so, yeah, he'd been a kind of musical mentor of mine before all this. And so I asked him to produce the album. And during the process, because he'd produced the Katrin and Seko album as well. And during this sort of, I can't remember when it was, but he said, "Oh, you know, I remember going to Wales as a kid. To my gran used to live in Wales, so he had a connection with Wales." And then we were trying to figure out where it was. And he said, and then he said, oh, I think he'd asked his mum, and he said it was Pontchan. I was like, are you kidding? Pontchan is like the next village up from Capeldewi.
No.
And it turns out his grandmother had lived in the same village that I grew up in.
No way. Wow.
Back in the 60s.
Wow.
And people still remember her. And so he ends up producing this album with songs predominantly from the Kletur Valley by accident. Or was it by accident?
Yeah,
I don't know. Well. But that, I just, there were things like that happened as maybe I think, it's totally, this like album has got to happen, whatever it is.
Like those songs were in his family as well.
I don't know about the songs. It might be that, you know, I'm sure his grandmother probably would have known Daft Jones, the Balladeer. You know?
Yeah.
So there was a link. There's a link. Yeah, totally.
Wow.
And that was just a strange thing that happened. And his involvement was really crucial because he gave me a lot of support. And when you're applying for grants and things, it's really important to have industry support. Otherwise, the Arts Council don't take you seriously and right. all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
He was really key. So the sound of the album, I would say, is definitely... in part due to him.
Yeah, there's a bit, it kind of reminds me a little bit of sort of like Brighter Later era Nick Drake with the trumpets and the gentle double bassy stuff and the sort of like soft drums.
Yeah.
And then I get like...
He's a vibes man. You know, I always know John's enjoying something because he would sit in the studio on the chair and he'd just be like this.
Yeah, that's it.
That was always the sign that the vibe was right. So it's good to have somebody in a studio who's not you, who's more objective, who can sit there and go, yeah, it was take six or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's the brilliant thing about the kind of recording process when you work with the right person as a musician.
Yeah.
And that you sort of... Yeah, it doesn't work quite the same way in other forms.
Yeah. And so, you know, an album is a snapshot of where you are at a particular point in time. And that's where I was, you know, 3-4 years ago. And it's sustained me since then, you know, and I've just been on tour last week with a band and people still liking it. So
have you been, how's your kind of, when you first released it till sort of now, how have you been feeling about the reception and the kind of, because a lot of people in a lot of places have said really nice things about it.
Yeah, no, I had some really lovely reviews and it was a shame that it was just before COVID, that kind of scuppered things a bit. But I think I was very fortunate during COVID to get enough work and support. But it's a shame not to be able to take it out on the road, but everyone's in the same boat.
Yeah.
So I'm not bitter about it at all.
No.
It's more that you move on a little bit from, you start thinking about what's next.
Yeah.
So I guess I've been more in that space, but no, I've been, yeah, I did a crowdfunder for it, which went better than I could have ever imagined. I think that was very kind of validating in a way that, because it's initially, it's quite a nerve-wracking thing putting something. I mean, you've done crowdfunders, you know, with your book. You have no idea how people are going to respond to it.
It was really nerve-wracking, and it's an absolute fuck ton of work, especially if you're doing it mostly yourself.
Yeah,
yeah, but also, it's also really empowering and really sort of, really, like you say, sort of really validates the fact that. Okay, people believe in what I'm doing and they're willing to support me financially and with their energy, and that gives you a certain level of extra confidence to push and get something done to a high standard as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it helped me think, well, actually, yeah, this is not just a mad idea. People are into it and I need to follow through now because they've given me their money and, you know, there's a bit of a deadline.
Yeah, but that's a great thing to have. Yeah. I work really well when there's something going on with the deadline. If I don't have a deadline, I tend to just be really floaty and distracted and I'll be into all sorts of other things except the thing that I'm trying to work
on.
True.
Yeah, there's a kind of balance, isn't there?
Somewhere? Yeah. But,
that was, and I, going back to, you know, what we started talking about at Embercombe, it was realizing that it felt important to me to cross that bridge in terms of my visibility in the world. And if I was serious about music, then it meant being public and it meant being open to nice reviews and criticism.
Yeah.
And that's always...
That's a challenging
step,
isn't it?
But it can be for lots of people. Yeah. It was for me challenging to just... stick it out there and just see what happens,
especially when things are, you know, are personal and there's a it's obviously very connected to you and your family and your childhood and your yeah. sort of path through life as well. Yeah. And your cultural context, yeah. everything. It's very, so yeah, yeah. It's a very vulnerable thing to put yeah. your art out into the world when it's even more as a personal, it has that personal weight to it.
Yes. It wasn't like I was an indie rock band with four just members who co-wrote. It was,
yeah.
And I remember initially when I started off, I was trying to find a singer to work with because I didn't think I wanted to be the singer.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So first year or so, I was trying to find a singer. And then as time went on and I was performing more, I started realizing, oh, no, Owen, this is you. You need to figure this one out.
Yeah.
And get up on a stage and it be about you. Mm. And there was a part of me that was really reluctant to do that.
Okay.
I still is. You know, I still struggle with that from time to time. But
well, I get really like... Erland Oyer, Kings of Convenience, kind of, do you remember the Kings of Convenience? Yeah. That's your voice. There's a real, like, that kind of like softness, but it's rich and it's kind of, obviously I'm not familiar with the language, but it's very solid in a soft way. It's how I'd say.
Well, that's been a whole other journey. I mean,
the singing.
Yeah, it's not something that comes easily to me. You know, I've had to work at it, and I think singing is one of the most, for me anyway, I think it's one of the most vulnerable things you can do. Actually, I'd almost rather be naked on the stage than sing. It sounds mad, but I think it is. You're really bearing your soul when you sing.
Yeah,
and that's been a whole learning journey about
that whole thing.
How to embody that on a stage, and I still feel like I'm learning all the time. But
yeah. It's tied in with the sort of public speaking, isn't it? It's like when you
yeah.
put yourself and your voice center stage and everyone's focusing on that attention on you.
Yeah.
That's the thing where people are like, oh, but I'd imagine if you can meet that and practice working through that and going above that, that can be very empowering itself to be like,
yes,
I'm doing this and I
yeah.
am doing this well and
yeah.
people are enjoying it.
Exactly. And it, you know, I mean, I think I'm very grateful to have, the support that I received at Embercombe in terms of understanding a bit of the psyche and more recently the nervous system and how we respond to different stimulus and go into various states of freeze, fight, flight, all that.
Yeah.
That's been massively helpful for me on that journey. And it is exposing, but I think with the right tools, you can navigate it. And I mean, just this week is a good example. The start of the week, it was the first gig with the band for 3.5 years, and it was like loads to like figure out and put together and managing everything and travel and food and all this. And, and then the first gig was pretty nerve wracking, but then by the eighth gig, it was relatively easy. And so that it was a real journey there from, actually feeling like, oh, okay, I can actually relax and do this. I don't have to, you know, it doesn't have to be an ordeal.
Sure. I can enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's been the journey all along. I think it's like, whatever, it sounds really silly, but just remembering that the experience you're having on stage is not what the audience is having. And 99% of the comments are really lovely. There might be one slightly, I don't know, iffy one, and you'll fixate on that one and then use that as proof that you're completely useless.
I've heard that so many times from different performers when they're like, oh, there's that guy in the crowd and he just looks like he's like absolutely hates this.
Yeah.
And then he's the guy who comes up afterwards and goes, it was amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, all those narratives go on. And I think as time goes on, you get better at being able to parent yourself in that way and just be like, look, the evidence is pretty overwhelming that people enjoy watching you perform. So don't worry about it.
Yeah, the performance side of music, I guess, like you're saying, is its own thing to meet. There's the writing, there's the, you know, all that side of thing that you do behind the closed doors. But when it's time to stand up and actually perform the music to people live, that is a whole thing of its own. So where's your head at now then? If that album, Dilynafon, if I said that right.
You did, yeah.
Has been out for a few years. Where are you now? What's inspiring you now?
Well, one thing that's definitely inspired me, I guess I've continued the research. It's just something that's happened. Once you start that kind of thing, you don't really stop.
Okay.
I finished the scholarship, but
yeah,
my interest in terms of, especially Ceredigion culture has, I guess it's broadened quite a lot. So I've become very interested in the Beirdd Glad tradition, which was the folk poet tradition here, which is really strong. There's an amazing book by a chap called Diarmaid Johnson. It's in English, and it really blew my mind. Mm. It's an amazing piece of work. And so I've been collecting a lot of books by these poets, and that's formed the basis for some new songs. So putting poetry to music.
How old are we talking here?
They were kind of at their peak first half of the 20th century.
Okay.
A bit before, a bit after. But in general, they present a really interesting window into a rural world, which was changing very quickly. Mm. So it's a great window into the past, really. And they were, you know, they were the kind of chroniclers of rural life. That was their role in many ways. You know,
yeah.
Was to write elegies to people when they died, or praise poems, or, you know, change of seasons or public events.
Wow.
Or, you know, so they had a very and still do have a very important social role.
I was going to say, is that something that still goes on to some
degree?
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah,
maybe not. I mean, is it to the same degree? I think what's changed probably is that poets have become more professional.
Okay.
Not in the quality of their work, but it's like, I'm a poet. Whereas yeah. a lot of these people were farmers.
Sure.
90% right. of the time, and yeah. 10% they would write poetry in the evening, kind of thing.
That's link between farming and poetry, there's something in there. Like Wendell Berry, you know.
Yeah. It's very much
a great
that.
Example yeah. of like someone yeah. who lives close to the land and is yeah. very connected and yeah. sort of almost, I think, as far as I can tell, quite deliberately disconnected from certain aspects of modern society. Yeah. But that, yeah, there's something about that being with the land so closely that enables that poetic voice to come through, perhaps. I'm not sure.
I would agree. I think there's been a big shift, societally speaking. We've stopped using our hands so much, and a lot of these people had their hands in the soil all the time, or, you know, on animals or whatever.
Mm.
And
out in the elements.
Out in the elements, very attuned to the seasons, and that shows in the poetry. It's an embodied knowledge rather than a kind of intellectual thing.
Yeah.
And maybe that's been one of the shifts. But yeah, it's an amazing tradition, and there's so much out there. I'm still discovering books all the time, and I quite enjoy the kind of treasure hunt aspect of it because they're all out of print.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, it's another thing to like
scouring for rare books.
So that's definitely been inspiring me, and I've also I've started growing oats. So this is a bit of a tangent now. Don't know if you want to talk about this.
Yeah,
but this
go
is
for
a
it.
Tangent.
Love tangents.
So when I was doing my research for the first album, I met this chap called Iwan Evans. Who sings songs and that, and he lent me some books, and he's just I can't know how to describe him. It's like he's just catapulted out the 19th century. He's just like of another era, basically.
Wow.
And he's just an absolute character. So yeah, we get on like a house on fire, and somehow, I can't remember how, I found out that he was growing Welsh black oats, and I'd found out that they were really rare, and nobody else in Wales was growing Welsh black oats.
I've never heard of black oats.
Well, black oats are native to a lot of the Celtic nations. So uh-huh. you get them in Scotland and Ireland, but they're different breeds. You know.
Yeah.
They're landrace oats. So okay. they're not kind of, you know, they're not been genetically
modified. Yeah.
I mean, they've been bred over centuries, but you know, yeah, they're not kind of standardized.
Not in a lab. Yeah.
No, or homogenized. So, I started growing oats. Got some oats from Iwan, and that's kind of spiraled off. But it's also, I think, coming back to the Beirdd Glad thing, it's made me understand. It's just, I guess, it's forced me to ask bigger questions around my work and the preservation of not just song, but also ways of life, farming methods, poetry, whatever. It's broadened massively just out from song, and. So what I'm working on at the moment will be a lot broader. So I guess I'm still framing it in some ways, but I think in some ways looking at more systemic loss.
Right.
And, you know, I've been looking at, you could make a comparison between So like an oat, you know, which has all the generations of selection and adaptation and evolution. And in some ways, a folk song functions in the same way. Like mm-hmm. the strongest ones survive, mm-hmm. and the not so catchy ones don't. And it gets passed on generation to generation. And yeah. so I'm starting to see these things in a more kind of broad systemic context. So that's kind of where my work's heading. So looking at also species loss as well, nature, as well as, you know, agriculture and folk song and poetry. And
so is your kind of the distillation of this, are we looking at something that's not musical, or are we still...
Oh, it will definitely be musical. It's all musical, but it's content wise it's a lot broader. So it will be maybe a bit denser in some ways, lyrically speaking. But yeah, I guess I'm hoping to use whatever the next album will be to draw attention to what we were mentioning earlier, which is that much broader loss. It's not just about somebody forgetting a song. It's a whole way of relating and being, which is going. So that's kind of where I'm at the moment.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's a wave, or not a wave, but do you feel like there's something in the culture supporting you in this kind of in this approach, or do you feel very much like it's kind of you're fighting against you know, the current, to keep the water metaphor going?
A bit of both, I think. One thing I've noticed is that things happen to me now, like the oat thing. I didn't go out and go, I'm going to be an oat grower. It just evolved naturally through my involvement with Iwan, and then later on the Seed Sovereignty Program, and stuff just seems to land in my lap, basically. And I try not to ignore that when it happens.
Yeah.
And I would say I think I've seen a change in the last 5 years in Wales. I think we, as a nation, we are valuing our traditions and our culture a lot more than we ever have done. And I think that's part of a general arc over the last 50 years, coming from a place where, you know, well, you go back 100 years when it was being Welsh was being beaten out of people, you know, and then in the 50s and 60s, you know, people seeing it as backwards and not very useful to the modern world. You know, it's valuing ourselves is part of that, you know, recovery.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. And so I have seen a shift. And I think if you can make a good case for it, you can get support and funding, and people are interested in what you're doing.
Yeah.
And at the same time, yes, you are fighting, maybe not so much in folk music, but I would say in other areas, especially in agriculture, you know there's a dominant narrative which is like Wales is only good for like cows and sheep and beef and dairy, and nothing else will grow here. I've heard that lots of times. It's just not true. So yeah, you are fighting dominant narratives as well, so you have to, I think you have to be able to make a good case still, like things. Yeah, you have to be able to work and not fight, but just be sure of yourself to the point where you can prove what you're doing, that it speaks for itself, so that you don't have to argue with people anymore.
Yeah. And I imagine with every project that gets some degree easier, because you've already got a track record of having, look, I'm doing this. This is what I've been doing. This is what I've done. This is what I'm doing. You know, you're known as somebody who, in that sense, is working in this way. And therefore, you know, it's not like your first.
Yeah. Perhaps it's become easier to take risks because I've got more of a stable foundation. I think that I would say that's perhaps something that, yeah, considering where I was 5 years ago, it all felt very like a small thing going wrong could end the whole thing.
Sure.
That doesn't feel so.
And like you were talking about before with the journey with your singing and performing and that kind of side of things, in terms of confidence.
Yeah, I think I'm a more confident person, certainly from when you first met me. Hopefully less serious as well. I think that's definitely it all ties in, I think, to, you know, a sense of what I'm here for.
Yeah.
You know, I think as you get into the, like, the other side of 35, you start realizing I need to do it soon, or you know, and I think I feel like I'm in a good place in that sense, that I'm kind of since I came back to Wales five years ago, like things have just sort of opened up for me. And so that feels like a, you know, validating. Is that weird? But yeah, it's nice to
it
have.
It feels
that.
Right.
Yeah. Feels right. There we go.
Yeah. So have you got, are you planning for 2023 shows or another tour?
I think it will be recording. Yeah.
Okay.
I need to take time out to finish writing, and that, you know, part of the payoff of doing something professionally is the admin deluge. And so it's easy for creativity to fall to the bottom of the pile. So, yeah, taking a bit of time out over winter to finish writing, and then hopefully, well, try and get some money together to record.
Maybe another crowdfunder?
Possibly, yeah. I'm going to, yeah, I'll see if I can get funding first, and then, yeah, maybe a small crowdfunder. We'll have to see. But it's, albums are a real labour of, I mean, you've experienced this with your book. It's such a massive undertaking, and there's so many things to coordinate and pull together, and it's not something you do lightly. And you can't really do it half-assed as well. You have to go...
I mean, people do. People
it's
do.
It's true. People do it. I guess I'm a. Yeah, I'm.
If you hold yourself to high standards of integrity,
yeah,
then
I'm a Virgo, so I'm quite pedantic about these things.
Yeah.
I think
it's all in the details.
I think that's a theme I've carried through my work. Always is do it 110%, or don't bother. Basically.
Yeah.
So I mean that comes with its price, but
yeah, but also hopefully good things come out of that. I mean that's
yeah.
I would agree with that philosophy totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, it's knowing how to hold it lightly, which is the key.
And not beating yourself up too hard for the times when you know, you can't quite meet that hurdle.
Yeah. That's always the danger, I think. And maybe as you get older, you get better at that, but it's still always a challenge, you know, not just switching off from it, you know. In when you're in the middle of it, not like in a disconnecting way, but just sort of knowing how to take care of yourself and not, yeah, you said, beat yourself up too much.
Yeah.
And it's a skill set I still feel like, you know, just like learning is.
Yeah, we're always just learning. Though,
it's true.
We?
It's true.
We're always just learning.
Yeah. So yeah, one thing that happened when I started performing was I found out there's a poet called Owen Shears.
Yes, I'm aware of Owen Shears.
He's from Wales. And people started coming to my gigs expecting him.
Really?
His gigs expecting me. And I thought, I can't use my name. And I was also a bit reluctant to, like I was saying, I didn't want it to be all about me at that point. So I was like, I'll use another name. And the word Kenevan's an interesting word because it doesn't have a direct translation into English.
Right, yeah.
So it actually comes from farming. It's the trails that animals make in the fields, the kind of habit
pathways.
Yeah, yeah. And
ooh, I like that, habit lines. That's
well,
nice.
habitat
okay
is a rough translation, and I was at that point doing a scholarship, and I really liked the idea of, I guess you call them, you know, invisible cultural song lines. So it's not just about physical landscape, but also about cultural landscape.
Mm.
So it started off as a musical mapping project, and it felt like a good name for the project. So that's why it's called Kenevin. So that's spelled Cynefin. So kenevinmusic.wales, and then normal social media malarkey. I'm sure you'll find me on there.
Thank you so much for your time, Erin. It's been a treat. I would highly recommend listening to Dylan Afon. I find it a really beautiful album when you're moving.
A lot of people play it in their cars.
Yeah, I love it. It feels really, there's a real fluidity and sense of movement throughout the whole thing as a whole. So yeah, I found that as well. It's really nice music to drive to or to ride a bike with on.
Great. I'll have to try it myself one day.
Hi, it's Jody again. Thank you as always to Six Organs of Admittance for the intro and outro music, also known as Ben Chasney, and Drag City Records. And you can find his music at sixorgans.com or dragcityrecords.com. To keep in touch with me, you can follow my personal Instagram, which is Life in Fractals. To keep up with the podcast episodes, it is Lumiere's Podcast on Instagram. And you can check out my website, jodywhite.co.uk, for all sorts of other things related to the work that I do, and my book, Chimera, which is out now and available at all good online retailers and a very select few independent bookshops. It's also available on bookshop.org if you'd rather not support Jeffrey Bezos. All the links are at my website, jodywhite.co.uk/chimera. And if you really enjoyed this episode and you're thinking, hey, how can I support Jodie make more of these podcasts and continue to go out and meet and talk to wonderful, interesting, inspiring people, then you can. You can go to patreon.com/Jodie White. And if you choose to do so, my deepest thanks to you in advance.
We found our way. La, la, la.